There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Everywhere we go, people want to know who we are and where we come from. So who are you and where do you come from?
I'm Lauren. I'm from Talla. I have two young kids, Jack and Harper. They're 8 and 4. And
yeah, that's it. That's all I need from you. So Lauren, tell me, you and I have been put in contact through a guy called Dean Kavanagh.
Yes.
So I came across Dean's page on Instagram. Someone shared a documentary he's had to do. And so who is Dean Kavanagh and what's the association with you?
Dean is basically a producer in the making, trying to get, you know, his documentaries out there. He contacted me about 2.5 years ago. Was looking for basically people to take part of a documentary for mental health in Ireland and how Ireland has basically failed them people. So he got in contact with me on Instagram, asked me to share my sister's story. So yeah, so I took part, and yeah,
because I asked Dean, I was like, do you know, why are you doing this, and you know, how come you're doing this, and absolutely, it was so important to get that documentary out there, for it to get picked up in the mainstream media, and I said, would you come on the pod and talk about it, and he was like, no, he was like, not in front of the camera, I don't do that kind of thing, but that's how he put me in contact with you. So tell me then about, we'll start from the very beginning, where'd you grow up, who was in the house, and what was it like?
So me and my sister and my mum and dad, we lived in Glenview and Talla. We loved that house. It was, we were actually raging when we had to move. But so it was me and my sister, my mum and my dad. My mum and dad, they broke up when I was around 7-ish. So quite young to kind of like, you know, experience that loss in your house. But I kind of don't really remember too much of my mum and dad being together. I don't really remember, like, so then it was kind of just me and my mum and Danielle in the house. So yeah, we had a great childhood down there.
So did you have to leave that home that you were in?
We did. My mum was on the waiting list for a council house,
right?
So she got the offer when we were around, I think I was around 10-ish, 11-ish. So yeah, we moved up to Ballycullen then.
And then what was it like what was your teenage years like?
It was a bit messy. So my mum got sick when I was around 12. So my mum had a stroke and a major brain hemorrhage.
Oh,
so that left her paralysed on her right side of her body. So my auntie took us into her care then. Now she gave us the best that, you know, we couldn't have asked for anything better, anything more from her. Like, she gave us it all. But yeah, it was very hard dealing with my mum being sick.
Was your mum brought into a home, or where
she was in and out of hospitals for 2 years. So in a coma for 3 weeks, in rehabs, in Talla Hospital, in Beaumont, in Dunleary Rehab. That was very hard to deal with. I couldn't go and see my mum in a coma for 3 weeks. So I didn't see my mum for 3 weeks, and that was like really tough. But I just knew it was the right thing for me not to go in and see her. Because obviously when things like that happen, they shaved the side of your head, like side of her head. I knew she wouldn't look the same. I was quite scared to go in and see her. People that were going in to see her were coming out and they were so upset, and it's such a daunting, like,
how old were you?
So I was around 12, then I would have been around just around 9, 10. So yeah, we were quite young. Yeah.
And in your auntie's home, was there other children?
There was. So my auntie had, when my mum got sick, my auntie had one child, Maya. Then she went on and had two more kids. So it was tough because obviously my auntie had her own family to look after and take care of, but then she was also worrying about my mom and me and Danielle. And obviously at that age, like, you're going through so much. You're going through, like, you're growing up, you're going through puberty, you're, you know, your hormones and emotions are all over the place when you're also dealing with that. And me and Danielle did, we struggled. I think Danielle struggled that a little bit more than I did. Mm. So yeah, it was tough. It was tough in the whole family, like.
Were you and Danielle, did you become really close in that moment, or how did you?
Funnily enough, I don't know what made Danielle think this, but when my mum got sick, I was basically, we had gone to bed.
Mm.
This was the night that had happened, and we had gone to bed, just a normal night. My mum was an OCD, like, freak. She made sure the house was, like, sparkling, like.
Mm.
And funny enough, we went to bed, and she just went in, said goodnight to us like she always would, grand. I know it was about 15 minutes later, my mum had gone downstairs then. And I could hear, like, the chairs and stuff in the kitchen move, and I was like, is she gone back downstairs to clean? Because it wouldn't even surprise me that if she had have done that. Mm. And went downstairs, but she was actually on the ground. But I wouldn't have known anything like the recovery position or anything like that. So she was on the ground, and she was kind of like an epileptic fit. But she was kind of foaming at the mouth, and it was like she was trying to open her eyes, but she couldn't. It kind of sounded like she was snoring, but she obviously wasn't.
Mm.
So my first reaction was to ring an ambulance. Like, but for some reason, my brain wouldn't work. It was like it was just had gone into shock. So I couldn't figure out the number actually for it, like, to ring an ambulance.
Mm.
So I had gone into my next door neighbour then, and she came in, put my mum into recovery position then, and then she rang an ambulance, and I rang my auntie then, and she came down. So they went in the ambulance with her, and then my other auntie came down, she took us to her house. We sat there waiting to hear news. So my auntie rang us about maybe an hour or two later. It's vivid memories of what kind of happened, but she got transferred to Beaumont then. Tala wasn't able to provide the care that she needed. So she got to Beaumont then, had major surgery. Summer school was taken out, put in a freezer, like, had the drain, the hemorrhage, and everything that was kind of going there, help her as much as they could, like.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just one of them things where, like, it was the unknown, what was going to happen in the future. Like, it was like three times she was on her deathbed.
How old was she when that happened?
I think she was 34, 35, yeah.
And did they know why? Just,
we don't know. She got home from Spain on the Sunday night. So this happened on the Wednesday, the Wednesday night. She got home on the Sunday from Spain. But my mum had given up cigarettes in around, I think it was a few months before that had happened.
Mm.
But they kind of said, like, it's one of them things where they don't know why it happened, how it happened. They don't have the answer. So it's one of them things that you're just unlucky enough that basically it happened to you.
God.
So they kind of blamed it on, it could have been the stress from not smoking anymore, like, that can, it then it could have been the pressure from the airplane, general stress, like, then it can just happen for no reason. It's just one of them things. You're just unlucky enough that it happened to you.
And then when you went to your aunt's then, is, like, are you and Danielle, are you close? Are you minding her? Or are you, like, you know?
So my mum was in the hospital for 2 years, so it was kind of like, we could only do so much, you know, for when she was in the hospital. So we were kind of like trying to live our life as much as my auntie wanted to give us, like, obviously the most normal kind of life that she could give us. So we kind of still live normally. So going out with our friends, going out doing what we wanted, to go into school. Like, I remember it happened on the Wednesday, and on the Friday I was back in school. My auntie was like, are you sure you want to go to school? I was like, yeah, I need that normality back in my life.
Mm.
But yeah, and I was pretty, like, it's one of them kind of things you think back now, like, Jesus, how did I actually deal with that? But at the moment, like, in that time, like, yeah, it was just kind of constantly worrying about her, but also trying to just take it day by day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my auntie gave, like, you know, she, I think she kind of tried to put up kind of a bit of a brick wall for us so that we were still living that normal life, but then she was kind of, they taking care of things in the background.
Mm.
So she'd look after my mum a lot and go up to the hospital every day and, you know, look after her as much as she could, like.
And when did you get to see your mum then? What was that
so
like?
So after the 3 weeks, I remember they were taking her out of ICU, and I walked into the room, and I just, it was so funny, when they had wheeled the bed out, she looked at me, but kind of took my mum a few minutes, but then everyone was saying that she didn't recognise every single person that went into the room straight away. It took her a few minutes. But I remember looking at her, and she noticed me straight away. But one of her eyes were closed, and I think it was her left eye that was open. And I remember just looking at me, but I knew she couldn't speak or anything like that. I can't remember the name of the tube that she had in her throat. She had one of them tubes in her throat, so you can't speak. And I remember her looking at me, but I knew straight away, she knew who I was straight away. But no, it was very, like, very hard to, like, go in and see her like that. Mm-hmm. It was devastating, like. Her whole life was taken away from her, like, you know, that kind of way. And so much to live for, and, you know, it kind of feels like a part of your mom was taken away from you. Mm-hmm. Do you know that kind of way? But, like, but she obviously so grateful to still have her here.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, like, do you know that kind of way? Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it was very hard to see her that way. And she had to basically, like, learn how to walk, learn how to speak, learn how to eat again, learn how to shower herself, you know. And then when she came home, like, me and Aniel obviously had to learn how to, like, help her. So we'd have to learn how to dress her, how to shower her, how to dry her hair. Things that, without sounding mean, but, like, things that you shouldn't have to do for your mum. Do you know that kind of way? So, yeah, it was very hard.
And were your dad around at all?
No, my dad was actually only out of Kilmere.
Right.
So he's an alcoholic. Mm. So he was down in a tie when my auntie rang him to tell him what had happened, and he was, you know, he was working on himself, so he wasn't much help to me and Danielle, if I'm honest. Always there, like, whenever time you need him, but, you know, my family aren't the most fondest of of him. So, yeah, there was kind of a few problems there, but...
They didn't want you really reaching out to him.
He wouldn't be much help, like, not that he wouldn't be much help, but he didn't even know what to do. It's kind of one of them things. So we knew that he was there, but not as much as we needed him to be sometimes. So yeah, so we didn't really have that emotional support from him, because I think he struggled with it himself as well. So yeah, that wasn't really a...
And were you as angry towards him, or was Danielle angry towards him, or were you just like, it doesn't matter?
Yeah, I think, like, there has been anger towards my dad just because sometimes we would need him and he wouldn't be there. Just because, like, a typical alcoholic would pick drink over your family. Not their fault, it's an illness, and I don't get it, but I understand it. So, yeah, like, there was anger towards him, and kind of like, well, why aren't you around? Why aren't you doing what we need? You know, he's good in some ways, but then not great in other ways. So... You know, I've had bad falling outs. My dad has stopped speaking over 6 months and stuff. Just, yeah, he's just, like, he's a great dad, but he wasn't always around.
It's hard because you just want them not to choose a drink.
That's it.
You just want them, you're simply...
You just want them to pick you over a drink. And that's something that me and Danielle, like, I still struggle with. It was only a few weeks ago that he actually was told that he has acute liver failure. So, and I'm not ready for him to go. Like, no one's ever ready for one of their parents to go, like, so that kind of way. So, but it's just one of the things where I just kind of feel like if he hasn't changed by now, he's not going to change. Without trying to sound mean or like I don't care, but I'm at that stage now where I'm kind of like, he's always been that kind of same way since I've been a child. So I'm like, I just kind of accept him the way he is now, and I love him for him. But yeah, there is areas that I definitely would like change about him. Do you know? So, but yeah, it was tough dating with my mom and then not having that emotional support from my dad. So yeah.
Tough. And that's like the alcoholism is just so fucking hard. It's so hard.
It's so hard for the family members to sit there and watch it.
And especially when someone gets so ill that you're like, you should step up.
100%.
I need you now to step up.
Yeah.
And then they don't step up.
No.
And you're like...
It's devastating. It's disappointing.
Mm.
And you just want to shake them and say, wake the fuck up. That's the way you feel about it. But why aren't you doing more? But people have their own way of dealing with things. And I think my dad is... He has his own way of dealing with things. It's not the way I deal with things, but I can't... I've tried my best with him, and it's like... It's kind of one of them things where you just can't change him. He just is the person that he is, and that's just...
And you know, you have to accept that.
Yeah.
And it is, because like I've gone through it, and you know, like now I haven't seen my brother in about six months. I haven't seen him, and I now like I'm getting that pang of should I, like, what if he died? And then I'm like, no, but Rebecca, you did everything. You offered him everything. You know, he was using you. You were, I was actually enabling him. I was enabling his behaviours because I was constantly giving him a safe place to come back to.
And that's the thing. And they thrive on that. They thrive on that.
And he did. And even when he fucked up to the highest order of fucking up, he said to my brother, bring me to Rebecca's.
Yeah.
And my brother said,
because they know that's his safe place.
Yeah. My brother said no.
Mm-hmm. Ain't done the right thing.
Yeah. And he said, don't even come down to this house. He said, don't even come near me. He said, I'm going to deal with it today. Mm-hmm. And I needed my brother to do that, to deal with it. But it's but don't ever, like, you know, be hard on yourself, or
because you just still be though, don't you? Yeah. It's like a natural instinct, just to be hard on yourself and blame yourself for them kind of things.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not your fault. And like, I've often even said to my dad, like, why am I enough to put down that drink and think to yourself, like, wake up? He'd kind of dwells on Danielle's death a little bit. So he kind of, like, but Danielle's not here anymore, but you've still three other kids to live for. You've grandkids who absolutely adore you. My dad's amazing when he's sober. He's the kindest man you'd meet. He'd give you his last €5 in his pocket. So he's not a mean, malicious man. He just has his problems, and that's the way he deals with them. But from my perspective, I'm like, there's just much better ways to deal with it. Now, he is in, you know, AA meetings, and he has tried to get help in rehabs and stuff like that. But the only kind of, I find with my dad, they only last so long until that all stops. And then he's back to square one again. Do you know, so there is only so much that you can help him.
But you know, like, nothing would be enough for him. Only that drink.
Yeah.
Like, the richest in the world. I have a cousin that I know. It's not a cousin of mine. It's a second or third cousin down the line. And the most random story is that he was marrying the heir to Estée Lauder, like an Irish guy. And they were two alcoholics and they lost it all. Like, so millions and millions and all the love and, you know, all the support and everything, kids, new babies coming to him. That's not enough.
No, it's not. Like, I know my dad's always at the end of the phone if I ever need him. And I know he'd always, he's there for me. If, like, I'm not sitting here trying to say he's a bad man. That's not at all what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, that's okay.
But, yeah, I think he can be better. And he knows that himself. He's often admitted it and said, like, I know I can be better. But he just, it's not that, I don't think he chooses not to be, but I just don't think he can bring himself to be that better man, because I think he feels like he's 65 now. So he's at that age where he's kind of like, I don't need to change, because what am I changing for? I'm too old to change now. And I do think he's right. I think he, you know, he has admitted that. So I think, and I do think he's right by saying, I am too old now to change. But I'm like, but it's never too late to change. You're never too old to change. That's my perspective on it, where his is different. So, no, he's doing good now. He's been sober for the last 8 weeks or so, so, which is good. And he takes it day by day now. He's taking it week by week. And, you know, me and my sister Kira are being there for him. We're doing what we can for him. But also, he has to obviously do the work as well. So we're hoping now, by him being told that news, that, because he basically got told, if he doesn't have one drink, two drinks, he's dead. So we're hoping that that's enough for him to never want to drink again. He's saying he's not going to drink again. But sometimes you kind of have that doubt in the back of your mind. But that is that kind of stop you.
Yeah.
It's because he's had scares in the past. He's had two heart attacks. We literally tell him he's the cat that has nine lives, because who comes back from two heart attacks? He can't put any more stents in his heart because he can't physically put any more. You know, so he's very lucky to be here. And we just want him to appreciate that and be grateful for that, because not everybody gets a second chance, especially when you have a heart attack. A lot of his friends have sadly passed away from heart attacks, and a lot younger than him. So he's been very lucky that he's gotten to even the chance to even still be here, you know.
So. And what is your mom like? Is she like back doing things? Like, at what point did she start it to be a bit more independent that you could start enjoying? Not that you weren't enjoying, like, but being kids again, being teenagers again.
I kind of feel like ever since my mom got sick, I kind of was never able to kind of be a normal. I wouldn't say like a normal teenager. So she was in there. So when she kind of got out of Dublin rehab was when my auntie took her home. Took still about a year for my mom. She was kind of like very immobile, like you know, she kind of just lay on the couch and, you know, it was tough for my auntie, like, really tough. She, like, would put on the brave face, but she was looking after my mum and looking after her own kids. And but my mum was still, like, very much not able to do anything for herself. I think it was around maybe a year after she got home. I could be wrong. This is just me, kind of just vivid memories of thinking back. But, yeah, I think it was around a year when she started to... So she was in a wheelchair. So she went then to... It was an association for people like my mum called Headway. And she got a bit of help from them. So she'd go out maybe once a week, go down to the centre, and she'd be doing things with them, like, you know, learning how to write again. Just little daily things. Even just learning how to pour yourself a bowl of cereal. Like, the littlest things is what she had to learn how to do again. So, yeah, it was kind of like slowly after the year that... Around a year mark when she got home was when she started to learn kind of how to do things again for herself. But it took a very long time. A very long time.
It must have been incredibly hard on you and Danielle. Like, not being... And, you know, because we all deserve a teenage. We all deserve to go out and to be in the field 100%. And have that can, that...
Yeah.
A sup of a can that sends us over the edge. Definitely. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. We all deserve that.
Definitely.
You know, madness that is our teenage years. And for you, you not to have that is just so unfair. Like,
no, I did. Like, my auntie, like I said, my auntie Karen, she did give me and Danielle the best that she could possibly... As I said, she couldn't have given us any more. Only for her, I don't know where we'd be. And that's genuinely Hannah. Yeah. I don't know where we'd be. So we were still able to have that life. I was still going down to the cat, like, down to the daughter with my friends and having a few drinks on a Friday night. Not that she'd know about it, but I would. Like.
Yeah.
So I was still very lucky. And then, you know, she gave me a little part-time job and a chipper that she used to own. And, you know, so everything that she had done was, she was doing it for me, Danielle, my mum, and her own family. And I'll always be grateful for that. So, no, we were still able to have that, thankfully. But as I said, if my auntie wasn't around, I don't know what way my life would be now. I really don't. And I don't know where my mum would be, whatever.
And at what point did you start to see Danielle was struggling?
Oh, Danielle was... It was like Danielle was born an upset child. You look at Danielle and the sadness in her eyes. Oh, my God. People would comment on it, like... Even all my family were like, Danielle always had the saddest eyes. So it was kind of like, it's like she was born with depression, basically. So when my mum got sick and my mum and dad broke up, Danielle really, like, struggled with that. But she particularly struggled with my mum being sick. She just couldn't deal with it, couldn't face it. And she kind of hid herself away from it. So she wouldn't really help my auntie help my mum. So, to help my mum. So... That would cause arguments in the house, and then, you know, Danielle would be like, so my auntie would be very good that way, like, she'd give us the time, but it wouldn't be too early to come home. She'd say, right, you'd have to be home by 10 o'clock. And I was always fine with that. I was like, yeah, that's perfect. Not saying I'd always be bang on at the door at 10 o'clock, but Danielle would take the piss. She wouldn't come home, and she'd, it was like as if Danielle's anger towards what had happened to my mum, but she'd take it out on the whole world. She hated everybody. She had no time for anybody. She constantly have arguments. She was going into school. I remember even one day in school, she was walking past me, and this brick wall in the school, just where the toilets were, and she fucked me into the wall. We had an argument, but I can't even remember what the argument was about. But just a very angry person. The smallest thing that said to me, she was like a ticking time bomb waiting to go off. And we don't know why. It's just like she just struggled with my mum, my dad, obviously not being able to live that kind of normal, like, family unit in your own house. And, of course, like, I struggled with it big time. Of course I did. But Danielle was, like, when she was younger, she struggled with her weight, kind of always a little bit more overweight than your typical, like, say, seven-year-old girl, like, you know, where I was more, I wouldn't have had that problem. So Danielle would have kind of always been in, like, if she was, say, seven, she'd probably be in nine-year-old girl's clothes. Where I was always in my... like, age group clothes. And I think Danielle struggled with that and stuff. And then my mum would be like, have they go into the change rooms? They kill each other in the change rooms. My mum would have a short fuse, so she wouldn't have the most amount of patience when it came to Danielle as well. So if my mum brought us out shopping, it would always end up in an argument. Always. So Danielle struggled with, I think, our weight a little bit. And then, yeah, she was just always, like, just a sad child. No matter what you done, we got brought on the best of holidays. My auntie brought us to Florida. We went to Italy. We're going to Spain. She had the best life. Obviously, yeah, what had happened to my mom, Danielle struggled with, but we had the best life. We really did. So we never really understood where all the anger and sadness came from. It was kind of one of them things that was kind of like, right, okay. But then I think as Danielle got older, it started to get worse. And Danielle started to self-harm. You'd constantly find knives and scissors and stuff in her drawers and my dad's. She lived with my dad then. You'd find knives and scissors and stuff in her bedroom. We'd take them out.
When did she move to your dad's?
Sorry, I'm probably going.
You're okay.
I'm running away.
You're not?
So I think my auntie basically just had enough. Danielle wasn't doing what she was. She was taking the piss out of my auntie basically and just not doing what my auntie had asked. And it wouldn't be much that my auntie would ask for. Come home at this time. Yeah, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But Danielle wouldn't be doing that. She'd have her room would be a mess, just cheeky, throwing tantrums, just, yeah. But, yeah, so I think she moved to my dad's around, I think, when she was around 14. Yeah, around 14. So my dad has a two-bedroom apartment over in Stepaside. So she moved over there. And, yeah, you just find stuff like knives and scissors and stuff in her room. I'd end up taking them out. I wouldn't tell her, but not that I would. It made a difference, me taking them out. But you just be thinking you're doing the right thing by taking them out. Mm. Overdosed twice. But it's kind of one of them things where you're like, right, okay, we'll deal with it. But I think it was one of them things where we couldn't get to the root of the problem. So my dad brought her to Peter House, tried to get her the help that she needed. And she was doing, she was doing well. And they discharged her. Then a few months, I think, later, she kind of started to feel depressed and stuff again, but I brought her back. She wasn't always the easiest to deal with.
And the self-harm, and was this going on a long time before you found it?
Yeah, it was probably the case about 3 to 4 years that she was just cutting herself, and it's just horrible to see. Mm. Horrible, you'd be like, why are you doing it? I just didn't understand what she would get from it. I don't know, what you would get from it.
Mm.
I've never been in that place where I feel like I'd need to do something like that. Mm. So I never really understood it, but it's awful to watch. Awful. You just want to help her. Mm-hmm. And it's like she wouldn't let you in. It was like a blank book. You just didn't understand why she was doing what she was doing. So yeah, I don't know. It's just a very sad girl,
and I don't think, we always say oh, look at her eyes, oh, she's lovely sad eyes, but I actually haven't spoke to anyone throughout this whole podcast. I can't, that they always had a reason for their breakdown. Mm-hmm. There was always something, David Gorman, his was injuring his leg. And that's how he became depressed.
Yeah.
And, lots of things we know, this is why they were depressed. But obviously, with your sister, it was as you said, from the very beginning. Yeah.
I don't really remember much of her being, she'd always smile and make a joke and stuff. It was always them sad eyes that would just get you and be like, what is going on in your head that you just can't, she'd never had a spark in her eye.
Mm.
We had a great childhood, honestly. My mom couldn't have done more for us. She was a single mother. And I remember, we'd sit in our bedroom and we'd sit there and play Barbie dolls for hours. We'd go out on our bikes and we had the same, because there's only 2 years between me and Danielle, so we had the same kind of group of friends and we'd always play together. And even on the road, we wouldn't really fight. It just was one of them things that was just always so sad looking. I remember I used to look around and I'd be like, I'd see other people with their brothers and sisters and they wouldn't look like that. I'm like, why don't they look? Why is it Danielle look always look real sad? But they don't.
And
just
when
as a
did
child,
it,
like.
Yeah, when did it start to get really bad for her?
Oh God, I think when she moved to my dad's, he was really good to her, to be fair. I think that was where Danielle was at the happiest, but then that's when it's self-harm. That's when she started to overdose. That's when she was doing them kind of things. So when she was around 15, I think was the age when she started to do all that. So I think that was at her worst. Yeah, so that was when it started to kind of, it was really like she was, it was a cry for help. But we just couldn't get to the root of why she was feeling the way she was feeling. And when we thought she was doing her best was when she died. So
tell me about that.
So Danielle was discharged from Peter House 2 weeks before she had passed away. We all thought she was doing really good. It was the first time we actually kind of, I actually have a picture of her at her graduation from school. So she was in sixth year, preparing for her leaving cert. So she had her graduation. We all went over to see her and she was, oh, she was, my auntie and my mum were walking out and my auntie drove over. And we even said to her, like, it's probably the happiest way I've ever seen her. She looks really good. She was in great form. You know, it was kind of like she was taking on the world. Like, do you know that kind of way? She was in a really, like, what we had seen and thought, she was in a really good place. Yeah, she went out that night then with her friends, went into town, I think, or to Bowland or something like that. She had lost her phone. So I had given her my, Danielle was always mad for an iPhone. So I had an iPhone at the time, I was getting a new one, and I had given her that phone. So I had given her that phone maybe 2 weeks before this had happened, and she went out at night. She had said her phone got robbed. So she was devastated. So I had texted her the next day. I said, look, I said, me and Dad will organise it between the two of us. Like, you know, if you do really well in your leaving cert, we'll organise it. We'll get a new phone. Like, don't be worrying about it. It's only a phone, Danielle. It's not the end of the world. And she was like, yeah, no, I'm just devastated. It's after happening. You know, I really wanted that phone. I love that phone. And then, like, you know, just her typical 17-year-old girl, like, all about their phones. Like, I was the exact same, my phone. And, yeah, so she was devastated. So, obviously, I had tried my best. But, like, I was living with my boyfriend at the time. Wasn't even working. And...
But it's not on you.
No. But I kind of felt with Danielle, like, I would have done anything to help her. Anything to put a smile on her face. Anything just to give her that little bit of life. And just kind of know that I made her even a little bit happy. Just as a sister, like, you know, you just want to do your best and be the best that you can be. And I wasn't always around. Like, when she moved to my dad's, it was, obviously, it was hard. I was living in Tallaght. She was living in Stepaside. It was a bus, a Lewis, and a half an hour walk to get there. So I wasn't always around. And I would ring her very often, like, most days, and ask her how she is, see if she's okay, you know. And we'd have, like, the laugh we'd have when we ring her. But, yeah, so I actually only found out I was pregnant when Danielle... just before Danielle had passed away. So I was kind of in my own little bubble, kind of like doing my own thing and stuff like that.
Which you're entitled to do, yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I was in my own little bubble, and it was actually when I was living with my boyfriend, I was living with his mom and his stepdad.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And they had gone away for the weekend. It was a Sunday. And around 12 o'clock, I remember I was putting a roast chicken into the oven. And I got a phone call off my dad. And he just rang me. And he was like, all I could hear was like Garda cars in the background. And he was crying. And I was like, what's wrong? Like, and he was like, the nails are jumping off a bridge. I was like, what? And he was like, the M50 bridge, the M50 bridge. Like, shit, they're jumping off it. Like, we're on the way to Tala Hospital now. I was like, what? I was like, what are you talking about? But didn't think for one split second that she would die. Mm-hmm. Because what had happened was, when she had overdosed, the social workers had said, like, you know, if this is going to keep happening, like, we're going to have to look into Danielle's, like, circumstances at home. You know, it could lead to a case that Danielle is going to get taken into care. You know, because basically everyone in my family had tried to look after Danielle, but it just seemed to be the only place that she actually was settled. But then obviously this was happening, so there was obviously still more going on. But yeah, so all I had worried in my head was, when I was on the way to the hospital, I was like, you know, she's going to get taken into care. She's like, my dad's going to get questioned again now, and you know, what, like, what's going to happen now? Not for one split second, I think Danielle was dead, like. And when he had said the bridge, I wasn't thinking for some reason, when he had said the M50 bridge, I wasn't thinking of like a high bridge, I was thinking of like a little bridge. I don't know why, I just, it's like my mind was, you know,
trying to protect me
and not think the worst in that case scenario, like. So I got to Tala Hospital then, and my uncle James and my dad were there waiting, and a nurse or a doctor came out outside, and we were just on the outside. My dad was having a smoke, and we were just trying to calm ourselves down and kind of, you know, be as calm as we could be in that situation. Like, and my dad came, or the doctor came out, and she said, we're just trying to resuscitate her. I didn't know what that word meant. I was like, trying to do what? My dad was like, Lauren, they're trying to bring her back to life. Well, I fell to the floor. I did not think for one split second that that was even going to be a, that was not going to happen. Like, not for one split second I think that would happen. And so the doctor actually invited me in to see her before they stopped. They were working on her for about an hour and a half, I think. They really, really tried hard not to let her go. But obviously, like, the injuries were that severe. Like, you know, the guards actually had said that she picked, I don't think she'd done it on purpose, but the bridge that she had jumped from was one of the highest on the M50, so, you know, it was inevitable, like, what was actually going to happen at the end. But
and you were pregnant.
I was pregnant. I was about 8 weeks pregnant. I'd only put it on Facebook the day before, so I was only around, I was quite early. Like, I shouldn't, even when I put it on Facebook, like, I was still too early to even put it on Facebook. But you know, you're like, I was 19, I was, you know, in my little bubble, I was delighted with my life. But yeah, so I was pregnant. So I remember walking in, and the doctor had invited me in to see her just before, you know, they kind of stopped working on her. They were like, just, if you want to see her before she might pass, like. So I went in, and no, you couldn't see, I couldn't really see her because, you know, she had a, like, a head brace on and a neck brace on, and, you know, she was covered in wires and everything that they were doing trying to work on her, like. And so I got to go in and kind of hold her hand, and, you know, there's not much that you can do, you can't really touch her because obviously they're working on her and stuff like that. But it was nice to kind of go in and see her before what had happened, because I didn't even think what happened was going to happen. So I was like, right. So I went outside then, and I came out then, they had said, like, look, she passed away. Oh, I was devastated. Absolutely devastated. I just never thought that that would happen. Never.
17 years old.
17. Like, it's kind of one of the things where it's like, you never think it'll happen to you. You'll never think that will be my life. And I think suicide was such a, like, taboo subject back then. Like, it was 9 years ago now, so it was kind of one of the things where you never think it would happen to you. You'd never think, it was never a thing that was really talked about much, or you know, it wasn't a thing that people would really talk about much, and it was very much like I even heard someone had said to me before that when their friend passed away from suicide, like their coffin was put the opposite way around, because it's like they weren't accepted into the church, like. But yeah, kind of going off track, but
no, you're fine.
Yeah, just one of them things that you just never ever would think that would happen to you. As much as how much she self-harmed and when she overdosed and stuff like that, I just never thought that it would actually come to burying her. Never thought for one split second. I kind of always thought, I was like, I think she's going to be one of the people that she's going to struggle throughout her life, but she will get the help that she needs. And, you know, we have a good family. Like, we're all very close. We're all very much lovey-dovey, touchy-feely. Like, you know, that's the kind of family that we are. So she never, like, I think she always felt that love, but I just think it wasn't enough for her. So yeah, I just never thought it would happen to her. But I remember walking into the room then, it was like a room that they kind of set up for people who kind of just pass away before they kind of go to the kind of funeral home and stuff like that. But she was put in a room then, and I remember walking in, and I just, obviously horrible walking into seeing her then, you know, she was dead, like she was gone, like. But I remember walking in and I just seen this tiny little smug kind of smile on her face, and I was like, that's her way of saying that she's happy, like she actually wanted to, like she wanted to go. But then I remember kind of walking up closely to her then, and you know, I was kind of like, I was lying in the bed beside her and holding her hand, just kissed her. I just didn't want to let her go. I just did not want to let her go. And I remember seeing, like, she was wearing makeup and she had like two big tear marks kind of going down her face, and it's kind of like, what had happened in that half an hour? That what made her think, or what had happened? We still don't know what happened. We don't know why Danielle, she didn't leave a letter or a note or anything like that, so we don't know why Danielle done what she done, or if there even was a reason. But yeah, like even the guards had said, like, she brought when that she had left her like phone all the top of the bridge, so she knew what she was doing, so that they could contact my dad, or an emergency contact on her phone to like let my dad know that, like, what she had done. So she knew what she was doing. But it was just so funny because, like, she was out the night before with her friend and like put on her Snapchat stories, and she was having a great time. She worked in the local shop, like literally across the road from my dad's apartment, and she had her uniform ready for work. Normal Sunday for Danielle, like, she'd go to work pretty much every Saturday and Sunday, so she had her uniform ready to go. Like, so we were kind of just like, what had changed in the time that she basically, so she had a sleepover that night, her friend stayed with my dad's. What had happened in the time that she left the apartment to walk and her friend home, then to go into a bridge? We couldn't understand why it, or how it got to that. Someone had actually said, like, someone that knows my dad said they had actually seen her at the top of the bridge, but there was a bench at the top of the bridge, and she had her hood down, she had her earphones in. Then you'd never see Danielle without her earphones. They went everywhere. And she just had her head down, but the girl had seen it was Danielle, but didn't think anything of it. Of course she wouldn't, like, it's just someone sitting on a bench. But yeah, we just don't know, like.
And you'll never, like.
And that's the worst part.
You'll never know.
You'll never know. Mm. We have to live with that for the rest of our life. Why she chose what to do, what she done. Did she intentionally, like, did she want to die? Like, my dad's still convinced that she didn't actually try to die. She just wanted to hurt herself. But I think that's just him in denial that, no, dad, like, you don't jump from a bridge and like, expect to still be alive. So, I don't know. It's just one of, it's just, I think, without sounding harsh or anything like that, but I think when someone passes away from an illness, or I just think it's so different to suicide, because you have your answers when someone kind of dies from an illness. Not saying it's any better, it's not. But when you have someone who dies from suicide and you're left absolutely nothing behind, you constantly question why. Have I done enough? The guilt that lives on inside of you. constantly wondering why, like, it's such a horrible thing to live with. It's awful. You blame yourself. You blame, like, you just blame yourself constantly all the time. But even though you know you haven't done anything wrong, or you couldn't have done any more, but you still naturally do it.
Did you blame your mum and dad?
I think I blamed everybody. Mm-hmm. I think I just blamed, when I was going through that anger stage of grief, I blamed everybody, including myself. No one done enough. Like, these are the thoughts that you'd have. No one done enough. None of us done enough for her. You know, she wanted that help, but none of us gave it to her. But you don't mean it. It's just, you're going through that anger stage of grief, so you're just, you're in that mind frame, but yeah, you do. Yeah.
What was it like having to tell your mum? Was your mum fully comprehending everything?
Yeah, so, like, that was obviously, like, a worry, kind of, like, how are we going to... So when I had got to the hospital, like, we hadn't have told... My mum didn't know at this stage. And my auntie and my niece were... My two aunties and my niece were at One Direction concert at the time. So it was kind of like, how do you even approach this? Like, how do you even ring a mother or approach a mother and tell her that her daughter's died? Like, and because of the way my mum was, we didn't know what way she was going to take it. Is she going to, like, fully understand what has happened? What way is she going to deal with this now? So, yeah, my auntie, Marisa, went up to my mum's. She came and met us at the hospital. She went up to my mum then and just had to tell her. I didn't go where, so we don't actually know what way. I'm sure she just obviously got very upset, obviously. But she wanted to come down straight away and see her, so she came down, and then the three of us, me and my mum, and then Danielle was in the bed lying there. And we just sat there with her for ages. I just remember all I kept saying was, I don't want to leave her. I just did not want to leave her. But I think my mum dealt with it, like, as best as any mother can. Like, but my mum is in that mind frame now, like, that she's just grateful to be here. She's the most positive person you'll ever meet for what has happened to her in her life between getting sick and then obviously what had happened to Danielle. She's still so grateful. Like, she's the kind of woman... Like, if your house is burning down, she'd be like, ask Grant, we can build a new one. She's just not negative, like. Mm. So she knows, and she's accepted Danielle, like, not being here anymore. Of course she still has her bad days. I do. Everybody, like, does in my family. But, yeah, I think, like, she couldn't deal with it anywhere.
Your dad, did he get really bad?
Yeah, I think even him living on his own now, he struggles with the loneliness and blames himself. Doesn't understand why, you know, he goes back to that morning a lot and kind of thinks to himself, like, what had happened? Like, what happened? Did I not see something? Did I miss something? Did I do something? And I think that's where that gets him. But he was living with her, so I think anyone that, you know, if you live with someone and they take their own life, I think you're gonna blame yourself. Did I not notice something? Why didn't I notice or feeling that way? But I think when they want to die, I think they're so good at making the people around them believe that they're fine, because they won't expect it, so they're not going to be worrying about them. Because the time that we had actually kind of not stopped worrying about Danielle, we were always worrying about Danielle, but I think at that time we kind of felt like we could kind of breathe and she was okay, and that was when she died. So, and I've often heard people say that, like, you know, if they've lost, when they've lost someone to suicide, that it was always a time that they thought they were at their happiest, is when they decided to take their own life. So you just, yeah, it's very hard.
What was it like for you then, going through your pregnancy, feeling that kick for the first time, feeling?
It was amazing, but all I remember was, like, me and Danielle had a fight, I think around 2 weeks before she had passed away, 2 or 3 weeks before she had passed away. So Danielle was kind of into taking drugs, smoking weed, kind of, I think it was kind of just to block things out, to be quite honest. She'd go out and, you know, she'd be doing, like, taking ease and kind of whatever she could get her hands on, really. Like, she wasn't, I was saying, like, you know, she wasn't, she'd just go out and enjoy herself, basically. Mm. But I was kind of like, I'm the opposite to what Danielle is, so I wouldn't, I've never taken drugs or anything like that. So I was kind of pissed off Danielle, and then I remember I was texting her one day about something, and she was basically said something like, "Oh, there for you, oh my gorgeous godchild," or something like that. And I was like, "Godchild," I was like, "Danielle's not happening." Like, I was like, "You're out taking drugs left, right, and centre. Like, it's not the right way to be living your life. You can, like, you know, you're doing your leaving cert. You know, you want to go to college and all." I was like, "You're just like, I'm annoyed at you, like, just because I cared about her. I didn't want anything to happen to her." And I know if, like, she's over head on drugs, like, all of the catching though was like, what if she does something stupid? And I did say to her, I was like, "You're not being, like, the child's governor," like, and then I know she got really upset about that then. But it wasn't me trying to be malicious, it was just that, like, I kind of wanted her, I kind of done it in a way that I wanted to be, like, I wanted her, it was like a wake-up call to, like, right, okay, like Lauren said, like, you know, to stop doing drugs. And then, but it wasn't me trying to be mean, it was just that I cared about her. So by me saying that to her, I thought it might work, that she might just be like, right, okay, no more drugs.
Yeah.
Well, obviously it didn't work. So I kind of dealt with that in my pregnancy. And then, but I think me being pregnant when I was, I think it could have been the best thing that could have happened to me. It really was. It saved me, genuinely, because I think I would have been, I don't know what way I would have been if I wasn't. But it was only, I had Jack in the December then, so I actually got to bring him home on Christmas Day, and I think it was exactly what we needed. It's what my family needed, like. So yeah, no, the pregnancy was good, but obviously it was just, I had to look after myself when you didn't want to. I didn't want to eat. I couldn't sleep. I remember at the week Danielle died, I think I slept for 2 hours all week. Constantly just questioning things and, you know, organising the funeral, and constantly have people ringing you and texting you and just trying to be nice. And, you know, I remember how much support we got when Danielle died. And but it was just one of them things where, like, yeah, you knew you had to look after yourself, but you physically couldn't. Like, I remember my auntie making me, like, a bowl of vegetable soup, and I literally was like, couldn't think of anything worse to be put in front of me. So yeah, I struggled with looking after myself, but obviously I did. But I think it was the best thing that I genuinely think everything happens for a reason, and I genuinely believe that I was pregnant at the right time. And that's why Jack is my little saviour. Like, I'll just always, like, yeah, he's just my little saviour, like. But I think then I didn't agree with Danielle for the first, like, 4 years of Jack's life. So then I remember one of the Christmases, and I just couldn't snap out of it. I was just getting myself so upset. Like, why is Danielle here? Anytime her name was mentioned, I would just start sobbing. But I kind of wasn't always like that. I kind of just, obviously, like, I was devastated what had happened, but I kind of just gone on with things. I kind of wasn't dealing with them either. It was kind of like shoving them at the back of my mind. Danielle's name or, you know, her face came into my mind. I was kind of like, no, like, it's grand. Like, she's still overliving my dad. I was kind of in denial what had happened. But yeah, I think around the 4 year mark was Christmas Day. And I was just all over the place. I couldn't snap out. I couldn't get myself to stop crying. I was just all over the place. But I think that was when I realised, I was like, I need help. Like, I can't deal with this on my own. I don't know how to deal with the emotions that I'm going through. Like, the anger, the guilt, the sadness, the devastation. I was disappointed. I was angry at Danielle. I was like, I can't believe you've actually done this. Like, really annoyed at Danielle. Like, I was really angry. I remember there was a stage, like, I was like, I couldn't even look at a picture of her because I was just angry. So yeah, I rang Peter House in the January then, and I asked them for help, and they just basically told me, like, you know, your sister's gone too long, it's not classed as an emergency. They're like, we'll put you on a waiting list. We'll get, you know, we will get you as soon as we can, but we can't promise how long that time frame will be. So I remember waiting a good few weeks, and then they did eventually get in contact with me, and the lady that I got was brilliant, and it was the best thing I ever done. But trying to get that help, it was like, I've just rang up a bereavement counselling particularly for suicide, like, people who have lost, like, loved ones to suicide, and then you start telling me that's not classed as an emergency because Danielle's gone too long. How can anyone put a time frame on grieving? Especially professionals, like,
yeah.
I just was absolutely mind blown, and I honestly even said to myself, I was like, I'll never ring them again, I don't even want their help. But I think I knew I was that bad. I was like, I knew I needed it, so I just took it, and it was the best thing I've ever done. It really did help me, and I feel like grieving is like one of them things that comes in waves. So I'm like, kind of like, one day you could be grand and like having a, like, you can sit here and talk for hours, but then yeah, and you wouldn't get upset once. But then tomorrow could be a completely different ballgame. But yeah, it was the best thing I ever done. But
and that's, you know, we have to be really careful here. And what you said there, you could have easily went, fuck them. Mm-hmm. I'm not, fuck them, yeah. I'm not ringing you. Yeah. You have to keep going. Yeah. Because where's the alternative?
Exactly.
You have to go and ring, yeah, okay, didn't get me, but I'll ring again next week. Mm-hmm. I'll ring again next week. You have to reach out. We're losing way too many young people. It's crazy.
It's like one of the biggest killers at the moment in Ireland. Like, it's awful. It's so sad. Like, and it's so, like, even, like, someone in the documentary had even said that it's a hidden illness, and that's exactly what it is. And the government don't, because they can't physically see it, they don't care about it. Mm. It's not a priority in their eyes, and it's not affecting them, so it's not happening as far as they're aware. Do you know that kind of way? So there was no help from the government when my sister passed away. There was no bereavement counselling offered. There was no nothing offered. Like, so we're just a family trying to deal with that, like, you know, in that kind of way. And there was just absolutely no help out there. So and then you're getting told then, oh well, actually your sister's gone too long. It's not classed an emergency. How is that? How do you even bring yourself to say that to someone over the phone when they're ringing you for help? I just could not believe it. I was like, I actually hope. And like, and I like, there wasn't as many services now as there was years ago for people who have lost someone to suicide. So kind of back then it was quite limited. So I didn't know like kind of where else to go. So I kind of just basically had to soak it up and get on with it until they rang me. Like, where now you have a lot more, like there's even like an association for people who have lost siblings to suicide called HOG, and I've gotten in contact with them, and they have like WhatsApp groups, they have Zoom meetings, drop-in centres, and then you can volunteer then if you want to help other people who, if you've lost obviously someone to, like your sister or brother to suicide, then you can help them deal with it. So there's definitely a lot more now. But no, at the time, I just felt lost. I was like, what am I supposed to do?
And when you got in, because when you get in, you're in.
Yeah,
is that
you're
it?
In. Yeah. You're in.
And how long did it take you to get back on your feet, we'll say? Like, you know?
I think it was around, so I think you get 20 free sessions is what they give you. And then after that, I think you have to pay. But they kind of, you know, they kind of say, like, well, they'll kind of deal with that when it comes to it. Like, you know, that's not something that we want you to kind of think about. So, yeah, so I think you get to 20. So I think when I kind of got maybe around the 8th session was kind of when I started to kind of feel a little bit better. I kind of got to understand it a little bit more. I was kind of going through other things in my life at the time as well. So it was kind of good to be able to share them things with the counsellor as well, because they're not just, oh, no, that's the only thing you can talk about and that's it. Like, no, they're obviously counsellors, like...
Because I would have worried about you for postnatal depression.
Yeah.
After that. You know what I mean? Because you're going through it and then you just bundle of joy.
It was something that was on my mind.
Yeah.
But thankfully, no. Thank God. That wasn't an issue. Mm. Thank God.
Yeah.
I was very lucky. On Jack and Harper, I never suffered with the, like, I had the baby, I was, I think, 2 days after Jack was born. And I was just kind of all over the place, you know, and just, yeah, I wasn't in a good mind frame. But no, thankfully, I was very, very one of the lucky ones now that I didn't suffer with postnatal depression.
And how are you today?
I'm actually very good. I'm in a kind of an acceptance mind frame of it. I think what I struggle with, particularly with Danielle, is her not being able to meet my kids. So my sister kind of, like, so she has 3 kids. Danielle got to meet her kids. Mm. She never got to meet mine. So I think, like, that's what's devastating about it. Kind of just being able to know what she'd be doing now, where she'd be. And yeah, it was so, like, she was so clever, like, really, really clever. Like, she wanted to be a DJ. And her biggest wish was to always go to Tomorrowland. And I just would love to have seen her make it to them things, doing what she'd love to do. And would she have her own family? Would she be married? Would she, where maybe, you know, she may, maybe might have not had kids, maybe not have settled down. But just, I just would love to see her doing that. So I think that's what I struggle with now. But I'm a lot more kind of understanding of it now. I don't accept, I don't think I'll ever accept what she's, what not what she's, what she's done, but I won't accept that she's gone. But I think you just learn to kind of live it and live with it. And I think I'll just live life for her. Like, I think that's all you can do. It's devastating and, you know, it's such a huge loss. But I think what gives you that little bit of peace is, you know, they're happy and no one can hurt them anymore. Nothing can hurt them anymore. They're not being
tortured
anymore. Yeah. You don't know what's kind of going on in their mind. So I'm sure it takes the biggest set of balls to do what they've done when someone takes their own life. I could never imagine feeling that low, or, you know, that low in myself, that, you know, to do that. Like, so I can't even imagine what way they feel. And I really do pity people, because you don't know what anyone is going through. You can sit here and look at their life and cross around and be like, oh, Jesus, they have a perfect life, lovely house, you know. But you don't know what's going on behind closed doors. So, yeah, like, I think just, what if, you know, tried to, like, I just kind of, I learned to, like, kind of live with it. But I'm trying to, like, live life for her as much as I can. I think about her every single day. I talk to her every single day. I go up to her grave and it's not right. At Christmas time and our birthdays, I struggle in particular because I'm like, I should be buying a present. I shouldn't be bringing a bunch of flowers up to a grave.
Do you tell the kids about her?
I tell Jack about her. Harper's still a little bit too young. Jack doesn't know what's happened to Danielle. He'll often ask, but I'll kind of just say, look, she got sick and she passed away. I don't think he needs to know what happened, but maybe when he's older and he's old enough to understand and he asks about her then, I think I will talk about her then and obviously what had happened. But yeah, no idea. There's pictures of her in my house and I'd never try and hide her or anything like that. Like, Jack kind of knew about her since quite a young age, and I actually called him Jack Daniel after her. So he'll always be a part of her. And, you know, I want him to know. I want Jack and Harper to know about her. Do you know what I mean? She would have been, she was an amazing auntie to Bradley, Quiva and Gerard. And I know she would have idolised Jack and Harper. So yeah, like, I'll always mention her and talk about her, like, as if she's still kind of alive. I do talk about her as if she's still alive and people are like, oh, and I'm like, yeah, but that's just the way I like to talk about her. Like, it's not for everybody, but I'll say, oh, she is, or rather than kind of saying she was, you know, that kind of way. So, yeah, no, I'll always talk about her and tell her sorry.
So, before I let you go, just tell me quickly, not quickly, but tell me about the Deans. So, how much, yes. Do you know how many, the documentary, how many people are talking?
I think it's roughly around 10 people that were involved in it.
Right.
What's
it called?
It's called In the Shadows.
In the Shadows.
It's an amazing name. It couldn't have been, It couldn't have fitted it more perfect.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was basically people who were affected by suicide or have been through depression, anxiety, all kind of different mental health problems. So just basically trying to find help and how they were felt. I was lucky enough to be chosen to be on and speak a little bit with Danielle's story and kind of how I was failed by trying to get bereavement counselling. But no, it's an absolutely powerful watch. I think it should be shown absolutely everywhere.
It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
Mm.
If you type in the Shadows, Dean Kavanagh, it will pop up straight away. But it's absolutely amazing. It's so powerful. And I really hope the right person gets to see it so then they can show it. I just want the whole world to see it. It's just something that everybody needs to see. It's amazing. Now he done such an amazing job on it, and it wasn't funded. He'd done it all by himself. You'd honestly think like it was made like by a, you think it was on RTA.
I have to meet him. I'll have to meet him.
He is the most nicest fella in me. Mm. He's absolutely lovely. He made me feel so at ease. Like, it's not like, I took myself completely out of my comfort zone by doing that documentary, but I knew Danielle had said before she passed away that she always wanted more done for people who are suffering. Mm-hmm. So when the opportunity came up, I was like, I can't miss it. Like, I have to, even just to text him and ask, like, you know, kind of get in contact with him. And then when he had asked me to do it, I was like, yeah, like, I'd absolutely love to. So to be a part of it was absolutely amazing. Like, and, you know, he's so lovely. Like, he's just your normal, typical, like, fella. Like, do you know what I mean? He's absolutely lovely. And, yeah, like, it wasn't funded. He done it all himself. You know, he took time out, like, out of his own life to do this. Mm. And spent, you know, his own time and money on it. And I just think he really deserves recognition.
Honestly. Just try and get it out there as much as we can.
Trying to just share it everywhere and getting everyone to watch it. And I just think it deserves to be shown in schools, you know, everywhere. Because at the end of the day, everybody, I think, whether you suffer with depression all your life, or I think people always kind of go through like a bad patch in their life that they will suffer. Do you know that kind of way? So it's just trying to get people to understand, like, it's always okay to not be okay, and just to know when you need that help and to go out and get that help, because there is help out there. I know with Ireland is very much, you know, people are in literally in the shadows because they find it hard to reach out and get that help, but there really is that help, and people are always there to listen and to help. And there's so many organisations and volunteers out there that that's what they do. Like, they just want to help people. Do you know what I mean? So I think even just getting that documentary out there just to show people, because he even has at the end of the documentary that all the different, like, there's group chats, there's, you know, walks and stuff you can go on, there's all these different, like, centres and stuff that you can get involved with that can help. Do you know? And especially even for men, like, because I think that is such a taboo subject as well, that men don't talk.
Because I've seen there is a couple of men on it as well.
There is. There's actually more men, I think, than women, which is amazing.
And on that note, we'll leave it there. Yes. Lauren, thanks so much for taking the time and sitting with me.
Thank you.
And, you know, honouring your sister.
Thank you for letting me tell her story. It's something I've always wanted to do, and I really appreciate you letting me.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.